Visible is a wireless carrier that is not invisible. It is pretty clear from the name. Actually, radio waves are invisible. And I can say this with authority as a licensed amateur radio operator. That being said, Visible won't be giving you the power to see light outside the visible spectrum. It's actually way better because having that ability would make getting around very difficult and distracting. What you do get with Visible is unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. You get one line of wireless, just $25 a month, which is great in these times of economic uncertainty. That is one line for $25, taxes and fees included. So whatever you're doing at this moment, please stop. Switch immediately. Now, monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com. Wir gerne sehen, was ist los? It's deinen Freund Seth. I'm learning German. Yeah, in case you didn't know what that was. That is me trying to impress you with the little German that I know. Right now, I am actually learning German. I took it in high school. I goofed off the entire time. I did some other language learning apps. They taught me things like where the taxi stand is and how to find a bus, but not a lot of conversational German. Thankfully, that's what Babbel is all about. Babbel teaches you language conversationally, which, let's face it, that is what you want to know anyway. I don't know. When I was in school, you learned like how to count. You learned like the colors. You learned the shapes. Those are all important things, but they don't help you when you're in like Cologne, Germany with Ein Nierenstein, which, by the way, is German for kidney stone, an experience I can unfortunately speak personally to. But I've been using Babbel to learn to speak German again, better than I have before. I actually really like it because it is conversational. It's a little bit more relaxed. One of the things that it does that I really like is it'll sometimes show you what the literal English translation is. And I don't know why, but I find that very helpful in sort of understanding the structure, the grammar of a language and sort of putting myself into that mind space. Since I'm only in Germany for Gamescom, which is like a week, week and a half, I'm not immersed in the German language. I'm not immersed in German culture. So what I do is the second best thing. I'm taking Babbel. Hopefully this year when I go to Germany, I'll be able to impress all the Germans with how much German I know from learning through Babbel. The app has pronunciation recognition, so you'll be able to learn how to speak better with your accent, how to actually properly pronounce the words. That way you won't get made fun of by a group of older German men because you said apple strudel and not Apfelstrudel. No, it's really cool. I'm going to say right now there is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, because you guys are the best ones, by the way, at babbel.com/realm. Get 60% off at babbel.com/realm. That is spelled babbel.com/realm. Rules and restrictions may apply. Hello and welcome to Nintendo Voice Chat episode 637. Super Ninfriendos, I forgot to call you that, so please forgive me. I am your host, Seth Macy. Today, we are joined by Travis Northup.
Hello there.
Industry legend, Kat Bailey.
Hi, Seth.
And the anchor man, because he's anchoring that table in the studio, Pear Schneider.
Welcome.
Pear Burgundy right over here, except he's wearing green. It's a sweater.
Right. Very, very handsome sweater. Sonic Frontiers is a good 3D Sonic game, and we have the review and the reviewer to prove it. That's why Travis is here. We are also going to dive into everyone's favorite subject, Nintendo financial numbers, which
yes!
I absolutely go bananas for balance sheets. Specifically, how many Nintendo Switch consoles have been sold? It's a lot. Spoiler alert. We also take your questions and generally just have a nice time. So, let's get right into it and see what is new. Kat, you are the executive editor of news at IGN. You are in charge of covering all the news.
Wow.
Including something like the Indie World Showcase that happened yesterday.
Oh, right. Yeah, there was an Indie World Showcase. Well, Sports Story has a release date, finally. It had been previously delayed. So that it was actually a pretty slim pickings for the most part. We learned about Rogue Legacy, 2. We saw a few other games. Inscription is coming to the Nintendo Switch. If you're not familiar with Inscription, it was a real indie darling last year. A lot of the cool kids were saying that it was their game of the year. It's a roguelike deck builder. Quite pretty, but very different than you would normally expect from that kind of genre. So that's coming to Nintendo Switch. Great fit for it. So those were the main highlights, I think, of the Indie World Showcase.
Yeah, I liked... I don't have the list of games in front of me, but there's some cool puzzle games, like A Little to the Left, like organization game. There's that the game where you basically organize the Resident Evil inventory screen, that which I know everybody loved doing. I know it's so funny. They turned that into a game. It came out on PC earlier in the year.
They already had that. It's called Tetris.
There was that...
Unpacking.
There was that. I thought the game where you're like drilling underground looked really cool. There were a couple of really. This is a little to the left. If you're watching the show, you can see it here. It basically is.
Oh my God.
Organizing things by size and shape, and like looking whether something's nicked on one side or not, and then you get right in.
I love it so much.
It looks really cute. But there were a lot of really cool narrative adventure games, like Dodonia, the kind of French countryside, like watercolor looking game, looked really cool. But we all know the real hero of that presentation is Sports Story, of course.
Yeah. Of course.
And that game missed. If you've played Golf Story, you know it was a kind of cute RPG, sports-themed RPG with fun mini games that, you know, as you played it more, it kind of ran out of steam because it felt like you were doing the same thing over and over. And Sports Story, when it was announced, promised to fix that by having lots of different sports challenges, you know, not just golf. And then, you know, adding a little bit more of that sort of Harvest Moon Town flair to it. And they really expanded it. Like, the trailer shows... you know, it runs a little choppy. I hope it will look better in the end. But like, it shows lots of activities. It is a full-fledged RPG at this point, isn't it?
That's great because I don't really like golf, so okay. I'm more excited about the other sports.
I'm not a golf guy either. But Golf Story was just really fun. It was just a cool kind of, you know, classic adventure game. You know, because it didn't really have. And I don't know how deep the RPG systems here are either, but it's about running quests and chores, so a little Animal Crossing, but then actual action challenges that were fun to play. So, you know, like disc golf and all that stuff. And this new one has every sports ever invented, it looks like.
Every sport ever invented. High lie.
If you get, I don't know if it ever came to the West, but when I on the Super Nintendo, there was a Nushitsuri, it was called. It was a Legend of the River King. I think some of the Game Boy versions came out here.
Yeah,
which was a fishing adventure game. So like you explored ranchos and then you went and caught fish, and like this really reminds me of that.
What I've learned is that you can turn anything into an RPG. Totally. And probably have it be really really enjoyable.
Yeah, there's a. Was it a prop, a comedy game that was shown, right? Where you're where you do an improv comedy, or you know, play as a jester, and then there was you know, to your point, there was another simulation. Oh yeah, like game development. They basically turned game development into an RPG and adventure game again.
So yeah,
I thought the variety of games on display was really cool. There were few that this is jester.
Yes,
there were few that, you know, I think are looking like instantly hit us as must-have titles, but I think these are also clever and playful. The proof is in actually, you know, trying these games.
Is there an indie game that you're especially looking forward to right now? Because I have one in mind that I'm really looking forward to in 2023.
Well, you know, whenever the next Steam World is coming, which we know there's one in the works. There's another one.
Make Steam World Heist 2, and I will be there day and date.
Heist is cool too, but I'm you know, Dig is at the top of the list always.
I'm really looking forward to Sea of Stars.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Just Chrono Trigger, but it's from the people.
That looks great. Yeah. And then the other one for me is Horizon Chase. It came out on iPhone already, on Android and iPhone, I think. But the Switch version comes next year. That's going to be great.
Oh, there it is. You're watching the video. You get to see the delightful.
Oh, man. Yeah, it looks great.
Oh, it's so pretty.
Yeah.
It's Travis, gorgeous. Are you excited for anything from the Indie World Showcase?
Yeah. I like Jester. I did comedy professionally for a number of years.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, so
that say game, something funny.
That game looked really cool. And then Inscription, I'm one of those, quote, cool kids who really liked Inscription last year.
Yeah, I saw you kind of doing a little dance.
That game, it's really not what you think it is. You know, you go in expecting one thing, and then the game sort of changes on you, which is really cool. So I really like that game, and I'm definitely going to play it again on the Switch because it's awesome.
I didn't play that one.
Quite good. You should play it.
I feel bad because we didn't give all the names for the games here, but obviously Pepper Grinder was the dinging game. That looks really cool. That's like my number two pick after Sports Story.
Is that the one with the organization?
No, the Pepper Grinder is like you have like a little drill, and it's like almost kind of like the drilling sections from classic Mario games where you can go in all directions.
Gotcha.
and has some momentum where you can jump out. It's a cool looking little platformer. Dodonia we talked about, Space for Unbound, that's an Indonesian game, looks really cool. Once Upon a Jester is this one. Yeah, the improv one.
Yeah, that one looks cool.
And there was, what was the other one? Goodbye World. Aka, which looks a little bit like Tunic, but not stressful. Like it's with the red panda, right? That one looked cute too. Blank is a co-op game with black and white graphics. I think it was, there was some really cool stuff. There was an Indian cooking game, South Indian cooking game too, huh. Right? Like a adventure game with some cooking challenges and stuff.
What's the name of the digging game again? Pepper Grinder.
Pepper Grinder. Pepper Grinder.
That looks really good.
I think that looks really cool.
Yeah.
Little to the Left is the organization game. And then they showed a whole bunch of stuff. They had a little clip show, and that's where they showed Inscription. No, I liked it. But you know, with a lot of indie games, you got to try and see what's in there. Like the concepts always sound really, really cool and crazy. So,
and Nintendo has a little bit of a problem now. This is not a new thing, but there are so many games in the eShop at this point, and there's so much garbage that it's hard to find, surface really good games.
Yeah, what happened in the App Store happened on Switch, right? Where there are games that are designed to catch your attention by having an icon that looks similar to a game that you love, right? Like this happens all the time, and they're discounted steeply, so they get in the top 10, and then they sell well. So there's a lot of that sort of eShop spam now, but I feel like the games that they showed here all looked like really creative projects. So I think they did a nice job.
Yeah, and I would recommend following Tom Marks on social media.
That's right,
he's played all these games when mm-hmm. they were on Steam, probably even the ones that haven't come out. Tom already knows about them, has beat them, has a lot to say about them.
That's what a good reviews editor does, doesn't mm-hmm. it?
Yep. Yes, exactly.
He's great.
I've been playing a little indie game by the name of Marvel Snap. Actually, Kat, I wanted to say that was a welcome piece of Kat Vice to play that game.
Nice.
Also, House of the Dragon, you recommended, and I was not going to watch it.
That's not a game.
Until you said it was good. And
it really is.
That show is amazing.
It really is a Kat Vice at this point.
Do Andor next if you're watching stuff.
I haven't gotten to that. We're almost done with House of the Dragon. I didn't mm-hmm. think it was going to be good because, first of all, the last season and a half of Game of Thrones was so bad. And also, I tried to watch Rings of Power, which everyone was really into, and I hated it a lot, and I didn't even make it through one episode. But House of the Dragon, every episode just keeps getting better. And I got a lot to say about Rings of Power that I'm not going to right now. Yeah. Marvel Snap. I took it off my phone because I spent most of Saturday lying on the couch just playing Marvel Snap, and I didn't accomplish anything, and it made me feel bad. It is still, I think, my game of the year. It is absolutely incredible mechanically.
I praise.
The hook. I think even without the Marvel license, if this were just, a game that had an original IP attached to the cards, it would still be amazing. But the fact that you get to collect, I wanted a Venom card. That was part of the reason I kept playing, but I didn't get up to that high of a collector level. I'm at 167 for collector level, I think.
You still need.
Yeah, no, I had to stop.
So now we need a Switch version. So you no longer have to feel bad about playing it. Right.
Yes, I would rather play it on Switch, and then I can say that it was work.
It's for work.
I worked all weekend.
Yep.
Yeah. Seeing this B-rolls just make me want to play right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what strategy are you using, Seth? Have we got a movement deck, destruction? I don't see.
That was the other thing. I was starting to think of, I need to start YouTubing some strategies here, but then I was like, no, I'm in too deep if I do that. But what I was doing was they were the clone bay was coming up more often than usual, so I was using Nova and Wolverine and cloning them, and then I would throw Carnage in there and he would destroy those, and then they would, you know, power up all my other cards, and then I could just keep doing that, you know, through the six turns, and most of the time it I would win the match through that strategy. But also everyone started to adopt that strategy, and then everyone started to adopt counter strategies that, which I noticed. So I had to abandon it, but no, I can't control myself with this game, which is why I removed it from my life. And it is, I'm going through some withdrawals. Kat, I'm like you, I'm watching this B-roll. I'm like, ooh.
Yeah, I'm at like cards. 320 for a collection level now at this point. And the new season came out. I bought the season pass. So I've been mostly running a Kazoo deck, which would be like Zoo plus Kezar. And then I got an Ebony Maw, and then I've also been running a, what was it? I don't know. I've been trying out a lot of different things. Oh, a dino deck. Dino decks are still
OP.
In pool two. Yeah.
I pulled it up to see what my collection level is.
557. Very good.
Yeah.
What rank are you? Are you in gold? Platinum?
I'm in gold now. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm almost to gold again.
Yeah.
I know, Travis. I never know where, in what pocket dimension you find the time to play all this stuff. Because didn't you review like Xenoblade for us too?
And yeah. Like, that was a 150 hour game. Yeah.
You don't sleep, do you?
I don't sleep. No. I just play games. And I was actually playing it on the way here. So there you go.
Nice.
Marvel Snap. Yeah. It's a great game.
Jada was like 937.
Well, she's been playing since beta, though.
Oh my god. Okay.
So she must be at like.
She's been giving all these crazy pull three strats, and I'm like, okay, that's cool. I'll see that in 6 months.
They're always a bigger fish, man. Yeah. That's crazy.
This year, I decided I actually wanted to like follow hockey a little bit more than just the most casual of casuals. So I subscribed to a service that streams all of the NHL to your television. The Boston Bruins home opener, I went to watch it, and boom, blackout restrictions apply, which I thought was kind of ridiculous because I'm still 200 miles away from Boston, but whatever. Had I had NordVPN, that wouldn't have been a problem. I would have just gone in, changed my settings to another geographic area, and boom, I could have been watching all the Boston Bruins home games like it was nothing at all. So now I have NordVPN, and I can watch the home games of my local teams streaming without being frustrated. It's the same thing with like Netflix. It has all these complicated licensing rules, which from one country to another don't really make sense. So something you could watch on South Korean Netflix, you won't be able to watch on the United States Netflix unless NordVPN, boom, switch to South Korea, and you're watching whatever Korean drama that you want. I highly recommend you do that. I haven't done it myself, but people seem to enjoy them. And who am I to try to bring down people's enjoyment? NordVPN, more than just entertainment and sports availability, it's going to protect you, especially when you're traveling, when you're using public Wi-Fi. People are trying to get in there. They're creeping on you. Bad actors, people trying to steal your password, your bank account details. Who knows what the government's doing these days? I can't keep track. They're all over the damn place. NordVPN. It's going to protect you. It's going to protect up to 6 devices, because I know you have at least that many devices in front of you right now that can hook up to the internet. Boom. Fastest VPN in the world. You're not going to get any buffering. You're not going to get any lagging. It's going to stop your ISP from bandwidth throttling, which they do. That's kind of sneaky, especially how much you're paying those guys. There's threat protection to protect you from viruses and malicious malware and whatever else. Unsavory actors are out there. If you want to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/NintendoVC. That's nordvpn.com/NintendoVC. Victor Charlie. That link is also going to give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There is no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nice of them, and I appreciate that. Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts, with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for 2 women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Linsky.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
I did, after I removed Marvel Snap, I didn't stop playing games altogether because I just reviewed the Sega Genesis Mini 2, which I believe the review is live right now. Ooh, I gave it an 8, which is great.
I got mine yesterday in the mail. I haven't hooked it up yet.
It's so much littler than I was expecting. Yeah, your parents will help you hook it up. It is quite minuscule, and that is a good little system in spite of the fact that there's a fair number of real bad games, games on it. It doesn't matter because the stuff that M2 did as far as just translating games, or not translating, but porting games that were never on Genesis and adding the sprite scaling to Space Harrier and also throwing Space Harrier 1 on there as well, making Phantasy Star 2 have an easy mode, which is awesome and amazing. Like, it's just a delight. My one complaint was that it didn't differentiate itself enough from the original as far as the UI is concerned. Mm. But you know what? It's fun. It's great. If you can get one, which you can only buy from Amazon Japan, I recommend it.
Yeah, and just to be clear, Amazon Japan fulfills. It's still an American English language version. It's just that because of the lower numbers that they're cranking out for this thing, they didn't set up U.S. distribution. So they'll send it from manufacturing in Japan. And you can order through their website. It's
Order through Amazon US, actually.
Yeah, and then fulfilled by Japan. But yeah, it looked really cool to me because of the attention and care given to these games. Yeah. And you know, you're getting Sonic CD and weird obscure Sega CD games like the Mansion.
But like Popple Mail
sold and all that stuff. So
there were several games that I saw that were exclusive to the Japanese release.
Yes, there are a lot of games that are not on the US that are only on the Japanese version, which is a bummer.
Yeah. Oh. Like anything they didn't actually localize for release here. But then they did put some games in that didn't exist. The Puyo Versus game that never came out on Genesis or Mega Drive.
Super Locomotive and Spatter are the other two games.
Spatter, that never came out.
It just made Genesis ports of these arcade, early 80s arcade games. I want to say that one of the things that I found a little surprising and disappointing was with the case of the TurboGrafx-16, which I also reviewed, you did get all the Japanese games on there. When you switched language settings, it just was the PC engine.
Yeah, I think that's the best mini console.
Oh, that's really
cool. It absolutely is. I think it sets the gold standard. Plus, when you load a CD, it makes a little CD spin sound.
Oh my God.
How bad is Night Trap? I haven't played
Night Trap is so bad. I've never played Night Trap. My God.
Sewer Shark.
It's like you're never sure if you're doing what the game wants you to do or not, right? In Night Trap, I'm like, am I supposed to press now? And then it's like a horribly acted sequence.
Oh, the acting is almost as bad as the acting in the original Resident Evil.
How far we've come. That game almost brought down the games industry because people thought this would ruin our children. And any children playing this be like, this sucks.
What a mansion. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, it's weird that we went so hard on full motion video there for a little while in the game industry. There's Echo Dolphin. Echo Jams, classic, of course, by Chuck Person, is the very first Vaporwave album of all time, so that's a very important video game.
Did you all see that Analog did one final run of the Analog Mega Drive just recently?
No, I didn't see that.
It's probably sold out at this point. I thought briefly about picking one up because, I mean, Analog makes really great clone consoles, and with the HDMI and everything, that's an alternative to this. It's more of a premium kind of thing. But then I sat back and I thought, I was not ever much of a Sega person growing up. Mm-hmm. Like, Maybe for people in my cohort, like, you're either a Nintendo or a Sega, and I was firmly on the Nintendo side of things, so I don't have a lot of Genesis nostalgia, sadly.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I was a hardcore Nintendo fan during that era, but always loved Sega in the arcades. Like, we'd go out at night and hit arcades and just play Virtua Racing and later Daytona and all of that stuff. And so I always had a soft spot for their core games. And then obviously once I really enjoyed playing Sonic on the Genesis. But yeah, I'm going to hook this up this weekend and play around with it. I know the Shining impact is lessened a little bit because we do have some of these games on the Switch as part of our subscription, but not the CD games. So, and I sold my Sega CD way back in the 90s.
You just reminded me. My brother, who I am cursing right now, he sent me a picture the other day. He's like, look what my friend got me at the town dump. And it was a Sega CD and a Sega Model 2
that
someone had thrown away with a bunch of games and the light zapper, the Genesis light zapper, which name's escaping me. And he just gave his friend some money for it. And now he has the Sega CD, the second revision of it, because he's a jerk and I hate him. But he's also the same one who got an Apple Lisa out of the dump.
But seriously, we've had so many Genesis collections and two Sega Genesis mini consoles. We need a Saturn or a Dreamcast version. And I know Saturn's really hard, but boy,
Dreamcast is even harder.
What I wouldn't give for a Dreamcast collection or something like that.
Yeah.
It was like Soul Calibur and stuff on it. Be amazing. Sonic Adventure 2.
Yep. I agree.
I remember when Dreamcast came out. And I was like, I have no interest in it. I'm going to spend my money on a PlayStation 2 when that comes out instead. And I don't know why. I just didn't do both. I could have done both.
Why didn't you?
I could have drank fewer beers, but.
I love the Dreamcast. Whenever you mention the name, I instantly get like this raucous Samba de Amigo soundtrack playing in my head and remember that I still have two sets of maracas at home somewhere. Wired ones. That was a good time. It was Guitar Hero before Guitar Hero. It was so good.
Crazy Taxi.
Oh, Crazy Taxi.
Yeah, yeah, that soundtrack. Yeah, exactly.
Hell yeah. Take me to the Levi's store. Good game. Yep. It was a launch title too. Travis, you've been playing a little something for us, specifically as us being IGN. Sonic Frontiers, you reviewed the new good 3D Sonic game. You said it was a delightfully weird and experimental evolution of the Sonic games so many of us grew up with, and it feels like a very promising first attempt at what could be a bright new era for Sonic and friends. Now, you have a history with Sonic, correct?
I do. Yeah, it was one of my first video games.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So my question for you then is, Sonic 2 is the best one, right?
Ooh.
Answer carefully.
Probably, but I guess my personal favorite is actually the first Sonic the Hedgehog game, because it was like one of the first ones I ever played, and I think cried over trying to beat that game as like a very small boy.
Wow.
I was like, I gotta beat this game.
Wow. Did you beat it?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I beat it.
Well done.
Yeah.
And then your career as a game reviewer began.
That's right. That yeah.
You passed the test.
Yeah. My two early gauntlets were the original Sonic the Hedgehog and the Lion King game for the Nintendo.
Damn. I beat that game too.
I beat that game as a kid. I think that was the first game that actually made me break down.
You and Casey DeFreitas.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the original Dark Souls for me. And now I'm a big Souls-like player. That was the original.
I can't wait to be king. Truly is the swamp.
I can still play that level without like even thinking, because I got so good at playing through it, because it's one of the earlier levels. But
that
monkeys are throwing you and stuff. Oh, yeah,
it's so, the collision detection is so bad on that.
I could do that level in my sleep. So I really love Sonic, and I've played pretty much every Sonic game throughout the years. This one I was really excited about. It looked really cool, and so getting to review it was awesome. Thank you, Mitchell Saltzman, for being too busy to review it. He did all of our previous
games. Oh yeah, Mitchell. By the way, congratulations.
Yeah.
Daddy Mitchell now has a little baby.
Daddy Mitchell.
Super happy.
So how would you describe this game?
Yeah.
Because it's a little bit of Sonic Adventure.
Yes.
It's a little bit like classic Sonic, but also aspirationally has that Breath of the Wild openness to it. Like, obviously the pieces don't quite match up, right?
Yeah. It kind of reminds me more than Breath of the Wild of Pokemon Legends Arceus.
Okay.
It reminds me of that because it's sort of like their first attempt at it. And Arceus, I think a lot of people would agree, like, the idea was like, oh, great, you're finally changing up the formula, you're doing some really cool stuff, but they didn't get a lot of the, you know, details correct. And so I kind of draw that parallel with Sonic Frontiers because, you know, on its surface, it's like, oh, finally, we're Sonic in an open world running around at the speed of sound and just like doing crazy stuff and pulling off stunts, which personally for me is like what I've always wanted. It's like the open world version of Sonic Adventures, which is great. But then they also just stuff every single like Sonic idea they could into the game. Like there's 2D levels and 3D traditional levels that you do like time trials and you collect the red rings and that sort of stuff. And then there's, you know, like random references. There's one part where you play a Sonic pinball level from the old Sonic pinball game from Sega Genesis. Like there's just so many like weird things that they just threw in the game. And you're kind of like, I love this, even when like, I would say probably 40% of the ideas they throw out there are just like dumb and they don't work, you know, just like, or like the some of the mini games are like really just like, okay, I don't know why they put this in here. The puzzles are really like simple and kind of just, you know, like they could have just skipped it. Like there's a DDR game where you kind of like are jumping on pads and a jump rope mini game where you have to jump rope. And I'm like, okay, I don't know why they put this all in here.
It's a Sega game. Yeah. I mean, like if you Super Monkey Ball has monkeys in balls, but it has monkeys doing all sorts of stuff.
Exactly.
In it, right? Like they can't help themselves.
Exactly. And so I kind of feel like they just didn't say no to anything. And it, and that kind of like, that spirit is so amazing to me because I feel like not a lot of games try that anymore, right? Like not a lot of games have kind of just the bravery to be like, we're just going to put it all in. Let's say yes to everything. There's no bad ideas. And some of it works and some of it doesn't. But the way I view this game is I think it's just like, it's a very good first draft. And I really hope they stick with this formula and just refine it because I think the sequel could be a 10 out of 10 game. Like if they got some of the details right.
Let me ask you, did you play Ratchet and Clank Rift
Apart?
Yeah, there was a later level that where I felt like, oh my God, this is Sonic,
yeah,
right? There was an open world level where you get the jet shoes or whatever, and you just like zooming around. I'm like, please, Sega, just make this. Does it feel similar or does it feel different?
It feels very different from that. I would say probably like the open world stuff feels very Sonic Adventure-y in some regards, but it also just has like I don't even know how to describe this game. There's another thing I couldn't talk about in my review because I wasn't allowed.
Fishing game?
Yeah, there's a fishing mini game.
With
the cat is there.
God, I can't wait to play this.
Yeah,
NBC's favorite Sonic friend.
You guys should definitely play it. And what's funny is the fishing mini game is like way lopsided in its importance. Like you can play the fishing mini game and basically skip like huge parts of the campaign because the fishing mini game gives you so many resources that you could just be like, I don't want to do any Sonic levels. I'm just gonna fish. And then just fish your way through the game.
But on the other hand, you also have to fish.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not a very good fishing minigame.
Hey, there are a lot of people who are like, I just want to play a fishing minigame.
Yeah, you see, it's not a very good fishing minigame, but it's just the fact that it's in the game just cracks you up. You can see here if you're watching a video that like some of the combat sequences also just make you do like weird minigames and stuff like that. So just like every part of it, like there were probably 20 times while reviewing the game where I was just like, I cannot believe they put this in the game. Just crazy.
What was the craziest thing that you couldn't believe was in the game?
What was the craziest thing? I mean, the pinball one I bring up because it gets me.
It might
be fishing, though. It might be the fact that when I saw the fishing, I kind of like put the controller down and I went, okay, like what am I doing? What is this? I'm going to change my answer because there's one thing I couldn't talk about in the review that I think I can talk about now that the embargo is lifted, which is the thing I didn't expect them to put in the game most is the boss fights. There's boss fights in the game, and I didn't show them in my review. I don't want to spoil them for people, but they are some of the most like weird, unsonic-like, did not see it coming. There's four of them in the game, and every time you get to one, you're just like, dude, is this, am I playing Dragon Ball Z? Like, what is happening right now? It just is so crazy.
Really?
Yeah, it's really, really over the top.
But is it good crazy, or is it like
I would say the boss fights are probably one of the things that work. Like, it's one of the better things. There's some parts of it, like even during the boss fights where I was like, they have problems with camera angles, and it's just everything about this game it lacks polish, but it does so in such a like carefree, like childlike wonder way that I just kind of forgive a lot of it. And just like, I really do think if they built on this and made a sequel, it could be just like a fantastic game. Right here, if you're watching a video that this is the part where I talk about some of the technical problems, which is another issue. And if you're listening to a Nintendo podcast, so I'm assuming you're going to get this on the Switch, it runs not great. And it especially runs not great on the Switch. It's the platform it runs worst on. And so I was playing it on the PS5. That was the review platform. And even on that one, it struggles. It has like really, really bad visual pop-in in the open world. Mm. And I think it's 100% an optimization problem. They just, again, they throw so much stuff in the game. I feel like the game couldn't handle the fact that you go so fast and there's so many items and objects and characters in the world. So
yeah, look, there's a reason when you play games like Tomb Raider or God of War that eventually a character will get to a crack in a wall and shimmy through really slowly because they don't want to have to draw the entire world behind it or load the entire world behind it. And like with Sonic, they just went like, meh.
Yep. it's so funny because you can tell right away what parts of the game like they were having trouble with, because if you're in one of the 2D or 3D self-contained levels, perfect performance. Mm-hmm. There's no hitches. There's no pop in. It just runs perfectly. But then when you're out in the open world, you're like, oh boy. Yeah. Like they're just loading everything. And the game also has a problem where the longer you play, the faster you get because you level up. It kind of has RPG mechanics to it. And so when you get really fast later in the game, the pop in is like even worse because it's just like you're going so fast.
I was looking at a bunch of footage that we captured and Sega provided off the Switch version because I was trying to decide, like, is the portable factor enough for me to forgive? And like the big one for me is the drop from 60 to 30 frames per second on the Switch. Yeah. If you're watching this, we saw footage from Travis's review, which was the PlayStation version.
PlayStation 5, and almost all the footage I used was in the 60 FPS mode. The 30 FPS mode immediately feels wrong. It doesn't feel right for the speed of the game.
So take that into consideration. Like when you're on the go and you see games like this on the small screen, everything looks much, much better. But if you are primarily playing on the big screen, obviously,
it's on PC, right?
It's on PC as well.
Steam Deck, maybe.
Exactly. It would be a great option for the Steam Deck, probably. And it does run better on PC, but it actually still has really bad pop-in on PC, too. Yeah. So,
there was a lot of speculation early on that this was sort of a tech demo that they pitched and got greenlit. And they're like, okay, well, how do we make this a game? And
it feels like it was either in development hell and this is just sort of what fell out of it. Or they were just like, you know what? We don't really know how to make a good Sonic game anymore. Let's just throw every idea we have at this. Kitchen sink game,
just
right?
Throw it in. It'll like flesh it out. We gotta flesh this thing out.
Yeah, but weirdly it works, and it's one of my favorite Sonic games.
To me, that's so Sega, though, right? Like this is the company that made a fishing controller for the Dreamcast and gave us bass fishing, right? And so having
such a good game.
It's almost like Smash Brothers, like having little pieces of the history in there.
Yeah, I think it is like a perfectly Sonic game, and if you just love Sonic, like you're gonna absolutely love this game. And I adore it, even though it has so many shortcomings. I could see myself playing it more, and I probably will on a different platform. So
nice.
Oh, I just saw a
giant robot
from. No, I was gonna say it's one of the beasts from Breath of the Wild.
There you go.
If they ever actually make a truly great Sonic game, I'm not just like, not just a good Sonic game or a like, well, if you see past the flaws, this is amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
If they ever make a truly great 3D Sonic, watch out, because I think the internet will break.
I do too. Yes. Like, I just please, Sega, please don't give up on this idea. Like, I want them to make a sequel to this because I honestly believe it could be like masterpiece level, like Sonic is back, golden era.
But why? Like, what is it missing?
Yeah.
Is it just the polish and the execution? And what is the idea that gets it so close to 10 out of 10.
Yeah. I think the idea is just like the ambition, and B, just the whole like weird, you know, unabashed, just like strangeness and crazy stuff they put in. Cause to your point, Pierre, like that's super Sega. Right. And that, and I think that is something they should aspire to. The stuff it's missing is like, rather than throwing everything in there, I would like them to just focus maybe like 40% more on making the stuff you do better. Like if they had fleshed out the fishing mini game and some of the stuff that you do for mini boss fights, that's another one where a lot of those you repeat them multiple times, and some of them are kind of and some of them are great. And so it's really just like the kitchen sink approach that they took. A lot of what's in the sink isn't good, but if they worked a little bit more on making the stuff that's in there a little better, a little polished, and then worked on the performance stuff, it would be such a good game. And so, nice. Yeah, I really enjoyed my time with it.
I'll definitely play it.
You should.
Yeah,
you should.
Very excited. Some of my seven is like my favorite score for games, because if I have any interest in them and it's a seven, like, for, I don't know why it works out this way. Like, I think we gave the original Bravely Default a seven, and I loved Bravely Default. So that's like the one that immediately springs to mind. And everything that you've said about Sonic Frontiers is just, I'm so excited to play it now tonight. I have a confession. I'm playing it on Xbox. Please don't tell the audience. Yeah. Leave that out. Red, that's at 3259. Thank you. Yeah.
It's just like, and like redacted, you know.
So that was Sonic Frontiers. It's a seven. You should play it. It sounds ridiculous. I am very excited to play it and then talk about it next week. Now we're going to talk about what I promised at the top of the show that I'm most excited about, and that is Nintendo's balance sheet. We're going to see how much revenue they generated from overseas with taxes and the strength of the yen against the American dollar. I don't know if any of that's
no,
true.
That's not
what really matters. What everyone is always excited about, I don't know why, we're so excited about this, but it is exciting. 114 million Nintendo Switch consoles have been sold lifetime to this point. So that is what? That is the number two console of all time.
Yeah, Game Boy, right?
It's a lot of Mario.
Yeah. We actually have a chart, Red, if you can bring that one up, that shows where it ranks now.
Look at that.
So it's been ranking ahead of the PlayStation already for a while, but it's now knocking at the door for PlayStation 4. Obviously, PlayStation 4 is still selling as well, so it's not just going to magically overtake it. And this 117 million units sold for PlayStation 4 is not up to date. They haven't released a new number yet. But for those just listening, the top-selling console of all time is the PS2 with 159 million, followed by Nintendo DS with 154, Game Boy 119, PlayStation 4 117, and then the Switch 114, just behind the PlayStation 4 and ahead of the regular PlayStation with 102. So that's significant. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those are big numbers.
Beating the original 101 PlayStation.
101 million more than the Wii U.
Yep.
Which is... absolutely.
And remember, the Nintendo DS had to getting to that 154 million at a lower price in a different era. Remember, iPhone App Store happened 2004 or something, and then the world changed forever, right? But also with many more iterations.
Yes.
You know, Lite and DSi and all that. Years. We're on the OLED. Yeah. So the Switch with its next iteration is probably going to get rolled into the Switch number, and there's no way it's not going to be up in the top three.
Yeah.
I wonder, will it pass the PS2?
That was what I was going to say. I don't think PlayStation 2 will ever be beat, and I think the reason is because it was also everyone's DVD player.
Yeah.
No, I hear you. I think the Switch, it depends on what happens with the unit. If Nintendo keeps iterating it and upgrading it, it's just the Switch line of business, and they all count them. It will get there in 10 years or so, but or even faster.
So PS2 lasted 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, people were still playing. Yep. Certainly in Japan, people were still playing it in 2010. So
yes.
But if Nintendo releases a Switch 2, that, as far as this kind of means of counting goes, it would be a new console, and it wouldn't add to the Switch sales. So that's the big question here. It's semantics and how you categorize machines, really, right?
Yeah, I don't see the PS2 ever getting dethroned until either the population is much higher or there's a much bigger percentage of the population that's playing it. Just
when the aliens show themselves and we sell them on.
That's right. Switch fans.
People don't really remember it or understand now, but a DVD was such a huge thing. We had always, you know, we'd had VHS tapes up to that. And I remember just being blown away. I was like, I can pick whatever scene from the movie. I don't have to rewind it when I'm done. My God, I can watch the director's commentary on Clerks.
Yeah.
This is mind blowing technology. So DVD was such a big deal. And the fact that PlayStation 2 built that in, like, absolutely helped not only DVD get adopted, but it helped the PlayStation 2 be at where it's probably never going to.
But PlayStation 2 did not have built-in hardware iteration and replacement like the Switch does, right? I'm sitting here with my brand new Pokemon Joy-Con, of course, and I have a Pokemon Switch at home. I don't want to transfer all that stuff. You know, I upgraded to the OLED, and, you know, when people love the Switch and have the software installed, it's a much easier upsell to the next Switch level up. And, you know, maybe they'll be able to convert half of existing Switch users to the Switch 3 or OLED 2, whatever it's going to be, or Pro.
It'll probably be the 2, though. I don't know if you'll get it categorized separately, but
we'll see.
It's tough. Yeah, I mean, I was in South Africa and 2016, and they still had PS2s.
Mm-hmm. Wow,
they used that as a DVD player. A lot of people. So I mean, it's kind of an unfair comparison because it's almost selling a different product. They bought it for the DVD player, obviously.
Yeah, but things have changed so much.
Yeah,
my recollection is that the PS2 had a laser problem, misaligned laser problem. So a lot of people were having to buy new PS2s to account for it.
Right.
And then they also released the Slim PS2, was also a good reason to upgrade. So,
yeah.
It's not a clear upgrade path like you have, you know, like Apple basically created this problem for everybody that you feel like you need the next iPhone. Yeah. And when you get it and you're like, oh, yeah, it's faster, but the experience is not fundamentally different, right? And I think Nintendo likes that model. So. Well,
talking about the new Nintendo Switch, they haven't released the fully translated comments yet, but there have been some early translated interview from the shareholders with Shigeru Miyamoto, and somebody was asking Miyamoto about backwards compatibility, and he said, "I believe in forwards compatibility. I'm looking ahead to the future, basically." which a lot of people are kind of looking trying to read between the lines to see if whatever the next console ends up being is kind of support backwards compatibility, because that's a big hot button issue.
Yeah,
We'll see. My own feeling is that, of course, Miyamoto is always thinking ahead, you know, trying to think ahead rather than behind. But it was an interesting thing. They got some discourse going.
I mean, I've covered Nintendo for almost 30 years or something like that. And like, it's these answers from Miyamoto, if you go back in time, you'll find them everywhere. It's like, what are you thinking about? It's like, maybe I'm gardening right now. It's like, and then like 5 years later, you're like, Pikmin. Like, okay,
what's your hobby these days, Miyamoto?
Well, that kind of brings me to my question that I wanted to pose to the panel. You know, it's been over 5 years since the Switch came out. It's definitely starting to show its age, but I'm wondering, is the success of the Switch, you know, 114 million consoles, fifth best-selling console of all time, is that kind of its own, making it its own worst enemy? And I bring it for an example, like Grand Theft Auto 5.
Mm-hmm.
That game just kept selling, and everyone was getting so mad because it took forever for them to finally announce that they were making Grand Theft Auto 6. Is Nintendo Switch sort of almost not a victim, but for lack of a better word, a victim of its own success? Is the success of the Switch the reason we don't have a Switch Pro or a Switch 2?
Well, first of all, Rockstar is definitely the person crying into the money meme. GTA 5, so, and I think Nintendo's the same way. And I've said before that I still love the Nintendo Switch. And yes, like with a lot of third-party games, they're pretty blurry at this point. No denying it at all, but Switch is 5 years old at this point. A lot of consoles last that long. We're going to get Breath of the Wild 2 next year. It's probably going to look amazing. And I still play my Switch a lot and have a lot of great experiences on it.
I think it's definitely, look, as long as the hardware is selling, companies are not as motivated to iterate and release something new. Right. That said, Nintendo already did twice, right? There was a slight battery life upgrade unit. There was the OLED. So they are replacing, but they're cautious about what they put in those machines. And that's because of chip shortages, right? The pandemic really threw the market out of whack in that things were in high demand, which meant they were more expensive. I mean, try to buy a PC graphics card, right?
Well, and so that's why the Genesis Mini 2 is only available from Amazon Japan, because the chip shortage limited how many they could make.
Yep. So. There you go. And so that's the a little bit of the reality behind it is like, yes, it was successful and it's selling. And, you know, the reason you don't have a new Mario Kart is because people keep buying the old Mario Kart, right?
Ah, that's...
Yeah.
And 50 million Mario Kart 8 Deluxe have been sold. So almost one for every... it's an attach rate of almost 50%. Yep.
I think they wanted to release the Switch Pro last year. you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many rumors of it and chip shortages happening. And like, did the Switch OLED actually get rid of the new processor at the last possible minute?
Yep.
Who knows? But I think that Nintendo really struck gold in so many ways with the Nintendo Switch. I mean, we were just looking at Cuphead on the B-roll. Cuphead looks really, really good on the Nintendo Switch. Game. It's comparable to a lot of mobile experiences. And while the top end of graphics can have continued to move up, the middle has remained somewhat static, and I think that's been to the benefit of the Nintendo Switch. Extreme so I just don't think middles. Nintendo is feeling any pressure to roll out a successor.
I think that's right.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that it now in the state of the, you know, presumably the global economy, that Nintendo's probably feeling pretty good about the fact that they have a super affordable option that you know, it's a little tone deaf to release something like, you know, the PSVR 2, $600 in this day and age and that sort of thing. So I think they're kind of looking at it as we're the consumer friendly, family friendly option that you can take with you. And I honestly, at this stage in the game, I like their positioning a lot. And I think I would, if I were Nintendo, feel pretty good about it. So,
yeah. They're they kind of know what they're doing. That's why they always had the old processors in every, you know, the NES that's behind me has what, the Motorola 68000, I think, which is a processor from the 1970s, and they put that in the Game Boy as well. So yeah, Nintendo. I mean, here's my thing. Here's my personal worry. I am starting to get a little terrified that the sequel to Breath of the Wild is going to suffer performance issues on the Nintendo Switch, unless they keep it pretty close to what the original was, which would also be a bummer. So I don't know.
Didn't the original have performance issues too?
It did, but only because it went so crazy with like lightning attacks and things.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
When it had like big groups of enemies and lightning hit, then it got pretty gnarly. But generally it ran well, and it pushed a lot of geometry and a lot of distance and all that.
I wonder if some of the delays are because they're trying to optimize performance and get it to a point where it has that Nintendo polish, as it were.
Yeah, I'm very worried.
I hope you're wrong.
We'll see.
I hope I'm wrong too.
This
Good
is
Lord.
Their big one. They're not going to screw this one up.
Yeah, like Breath of the Wild, almost, I still think it's probably the best performing Switch game I've played. Yeah. I mean, like the people who worked on that game are magicians, because they make the Switch do things that it should not be 100%. Able to do. And so if anyone can prove that, hey, we don't need a Switch Pro, I think it's that studio. Right. So we'll see.
Also, you know, Nintendo Tokyo, look at Super Mario Odyssey. And just playing modern Switch games, I'm always like, man, Odyssey looks so much better. Like you go back, and there were some levels that weren't as successful, but you know, the desert level is just gorgeous.
It's so variable. Yeah. It really depends on how good a programmer you are, how you can deal with that processor and everything. There was also a couple of interesting items from the earnings, including Animal Crossing New Horizons is now the best-selling game of all time in Japan, surpassing Pokemon Red and Blue.
Damn.
That's amazing. And also Kirby and the Forgotten Land is now the best-selling Kirby game of all time.
Great game.
That's excellent. Deservedly so.
And Pear, this is some news that you helped contribute to. 77 million amiibo.
No,
and you own,
and they're all here.
7 million.
They were all ordered. His purchases.
I totally forgot. There's a set of 3 Splatoon amiibo coming out, and like now
they're hard to get.
And I totally forgot to pre-order them. Somebody mentioned amiibo on Twitter. I'm like, oh crap! And I ordered them from GameStop.
What actually is the best amiibo?
Ooh,
I have an answer.
Tell me which one you like. That's hard. I have so many children.
I actually really love the Link's Awakening amiibo.
Okay.
The little
plastic shiny one. Yeah.
It's quite simple, but it looks great on the shelf. Really distinctive.
I will say the newer the amiibo, usually the better they look. Like Min Min looks really awesomely detailed now, right? Like, so some of the recent ones, I think the Splatoon amiibo are really, really cool too. The quality of the paint, the way the actual paint looks, are really cool. I'll have to think about that, but I have so many.
The Skyward Sword one with the bird. Yeah. The Loft
Wing. That one is really nice too. I like that one too. Yeah. Actually, I mean, all of the, I really like the Samus ones. The one that came out with Metroid Dread looked really good. The Samus Returns one looks really good. It's just, it's easier to do like shiny armor and small figurines than like skin tone and all
that. The Fire Emblem ones are kind of the worst.
Yeah, some of them aren't great. No, the first wave with the weird stands are bad. Where they had those transparent stands because they wanted to replicate the Smash Brothers poses. That's enough amiibo talk. People haven't heard about amiibo for years.
Never enough.
What are you talking about? Yeah. Like 77 million people have.
77 million. Actually, speaking of financial reports, I don't know if you saw this, Seth, but when Nintendo was giving their financial report, they had the pie graph of all the people they've sold amiibos to. And Per Schneider got his own. He's like 2%.
Yeah,
he's like his own.
And Joy-Con, I'm about half the chart.
They don't think they listed the Joy-Con numbers, but they'll just probably be calling you up to get a headcount.
No, because they bundle them with damn consoles. That's
awesome. You don't have every amiibo, but you do have every Joy-Con. Is that correct?
No, I do have every amiibo.
You do have every amiibo. That's attainable.
They did the special edition, the prize ones, you know, the gold painted ones for some of the
Those don't count.
Yeah, yeah, they did it for Monster Hunter 2, and then obviously they're the Labo Joy-Con. They were contest prizes. Well, I don't have those, but I do have some of the rare, the other rare ones. Anything you can buy. I'm not going to spend crazy dollars on eBay.
Have you paid more than MSRP for any of your amiibo?
Yeah, because I imported some from Japan because it was some of the retailer exclusives were just so stupid. I'm like, fine, I'll pay $20 extra and get it from Japan. I'm too old to spend hours chasing a little monkey figure.
Well, there you have it. If you want to see a complete collection of amiibo, you can either go to Pear's house or you can go to the Nintendo store in New York. Both places have the complete collection of amiibo. So, well, Nintendo had a very successful financial year, and I think that's probably going to go forward in 2023, especially with the Legend of Zelda coming out. But feeling big things for 2023 for Nintendo, but I'm kind of interested to see what the panel thinks. Is 2023 is it Nintendo's year or is it another Nintendo year? I think would be more appropriate.
Well,
I think it's going to be humongous.
I think it'll be big too.
Any year that you get a Breath of the Wild or a Zelda, like a major Zelda, that's huge. It's going to be enormous.
Yeah. And you know, lest you forget, the year that Breath of the Wild came out was a big one. That was the Nintendo year. So I think this is the Nintendo year too.
The Zelda Mario 1-2 punch kickstarted the Switch.
Oh man,
it did.
Breath of the Wild is the most trafficked article in IGN history since we changed our analytics. I only know that because I wrote the number 2 of all time, which was when the PlayStation 5 pre-orders were announced. So
that's crazy.
Make sure the engineers know to harden up the servers when that review goes live, because it will almost certainly the God of War.
The God of War review actually crashed the site. It did crash
the site, but that's because we were bozos. We had some other issues at the time.
The biggest review I can remember is the Red Dead Redemption 2 one, and as far as like just people going absolutely bananas for it on traffic, and that was probably going to pale in comparison to
I think Zelda will go crazy.
I have a new IGN goal: crash the servers.
It's usually we're ready for it. For God of War, we just screwed up. We usually bolster.
It's a scary moment when something doesn't go wrong in an important time like that. But all right, enough about Nintendo financials. I'm going to close up the ledger. We're going to move on. We're going to open up question block.
Wow.
And I have a little, not a prepared statement for this one, but I really liked Casey Crossan, which, by the way, great alliterative name. I like that a lot.
Superhero.
Asks, what games stand out to you as having done a good or a poor job of explaining how they work? For example, the Great Plateau area of Breath of the Wild is praised as an excellent sandbox tutorial for the rest of the game, while the constant alerts, reminders, and similar in the original Skyward Sword were seen as points of frustration. At least that's what Casey believes. I almost pitched this as a feature, but I wasn't able to find the time to write a feature because it's almost Black Friday season. But I got to thinking about this when I was playing God of War, because the opening of God of War, and I don't think it's spoilers to talk about the first 10 minutes, when compared to a game like Breath of the Wild or a game like Red Dead Redemption 2, just didn't do it for me. The second you step out of that little tomb, that cave in Breath of the Wild, you know everything that you need to know about the game. It's expansive. It's the Hyrule that you've always imagined. And then you are, you know, of course, moving along and you're learning about how to play the game. Red Dead Redemption, the same thing. You learn all about this group, their motivations, why they're where they're at. You're learning how to play the game. You have that first like shootout with the rival family, whose name I can't remember. So now you know how to ride horses. You know how to shoot guns. You know everything you need to know about that game. It's opening from how to play it to how the story is going to be. God of War, it opens and there's a movie with some QuickTime events that you have to smash a button. And it turns out if you don't smash that button, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. So that's my biggest criticism of God of War, as far as in regards to this question. It fails to tell you what it's about as a game and kind of as a story in the opening, whereas something like Breath of the Wild just... In 2 seconds, I still remember the feeling of walking out and seeing that the first time. It's like one of the greatest moments in all of gaming. Yep. And you get to it in, 5 minutes? So, I think a great example, Red Dead Redemption 2, Breath of the Wild. I think a poor example, God of War. There's no reason why it needed to have QuickTime events. It could have either just been a cutscene or... you know, or a gameplay segment, but it didn't feel right to me. So there it is. Anyone else have?
So Seth talked for so long that I forgot what the actual question was.
The question was, what games have done a good job or a poor job of explaining how they work?
I got some. I mean, Breath of the Wild is really, I think, the gold standard, because it's environmental design that teaches you, and like you explore and learn at your own pace and you experiment. And like, there really aren't a lot of games that do it that well. Nintendo in its past, like if you go back, they did a wonderful world. They did a wonderful job with even with their platforms to explain how certain things work. Sometimes by even like whenever you have a place in an old Mario game where there's a daring jump or something where you're not quite sure how it works, there'll be an extra life mushroom or something, right? Where you go like, oh, okay, I can experiment here without risk of actually losing a life. And like that sort of stuff was always really smart, and it started to become the language of those games. Instead of punishing you with a death, it kind of like taught you and gave you an out. I think Nintendo has always been really good with onboarding. Sometimes Rare hasn't been. Star Fox Adventures, famously, you walk around and every time you pick something up, he's like, broom, 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 and he holds up some like spinning orb of something, and it has to tell you what the hell that orb is. And like the moment you have to describe what the freaking apple does, I feel like you're already not doing the job right. And I was really disappointed with that game. And how, you know, it just introduced lots of collectibles that weren't really important. And I think that's very dangerous. And I will say, Xenoblade is like that.
Yep. And literally the one I was going to use.
Even the new one, which a lot of fans are pointing towards being like the best one when it comes to onboarding it, still like 30 hours into the game, I'm like, okay, I got to go to the tutorial because I got to remember these two, like if these two characters are stacked behind each other, is that a good thing, right? Like it's still, there's so many layers, and I think RPGs struggle with that in general, that...
They keep sometimes, introducing mechanics.
Sometimes because also the elements and the names and everything is invented, and you don't have this crutch like you used to with like fire beats water, electricity beats, is it strong against water, like that sort of stuff, or water beats fire, whatever it is.
Yeah, Xenoblade is actually so bad. They have tutorials after you beat the game.
Oh, wow.
They continue to have tutorials. There's post-game tutorials because the new game plus introduces new mechanics. It's literally...
It calls you at night on your phones like, did you know?
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever read a review from me, you probably know that I hate tutorials. It's like my least favorite part of games. The best tutorial is no tutorial. So for me, highlights, I think platformers do it really well. Super Meat Boy is probably one of my favorite tutorials because they basically don't have one. They just every level, you have to learn something in order to beat it. And so Celeste is also really good at that, the way that they teach you to do it. And the games that do it terribly are like most of them, like pretty much every Ubisoft game, Assassin's Creed, you should get tutorials in the 12th chapter, stuff like that.
Pokemon, actually.
Pokemon, also pretty bad.
It used to be pretty accessible, but now you have to go to Pokemon school with every single one of them. You're like, okay, I know how to catch the Pokemon. But actually, I think in terms of RPGs, the gold standard is maybe Witcher 3, which introduced the White Orchard concept of, here's a little sandbox. Mm-hmm, we're going to teach you a few things. We're going to give you a little quest. You're going to fight a monster. You're going to have a good time. You're getting introduced to Geralt and some of Geralt's friends. And then you go into the wider world.
Mm-hmm. That's a great example.
I know a lot of devs study White Orchard still as like an idea of how to properly approach open world game design.
Yeah, and you had your first boss fight in there as well. And I do like games, and I can't fall, like, I'm a big fan of Ubisoft's open world games usually, and I do like games that expand over time, where in the beginning they don't throw every game system at you, and so you don't have to worry about, you know, how to steer the ships or use the cannons and all of that, and like it unlocks as you get farther in, and then by the 20th hour you're like a master of all these systems, and I do love that progression. But it is kind of funny that nowadays you still start a new game and like you're running forward in this corridor and it goes like, hold down the left stick to run, and then you get to a freaking fallen tree every time and it's like, hit B to crouch, you know, underneath, or hit B to jump over, and it's like,
and then still, the game stops and it's showing showing the text on the screen.
You guys do ever we play, still need to do that?
Do you guys ever play Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon? That tutorial level where it just makes fun of tutorials like it stops you like 15 times in a row to tell you stupid stuff you already know. Like, I kind of figured that after that, tutorials would maybe die. They haven't at all. So,
but in general, I think Nintendo is really good at onboarding you. But, you know, Skyward Sword in certain games, like, also pause things in order to explain what something was, and it really didn't matter, and like you wouldn't remember what the poopoo fruit was gonna do later on, right? Like, it didn't matter. Let me figure it out when I'm using it as a currency or actually when it has an application. And that was, I love Rare games. Rare at its worst tossed all these things at you and explained what they were rather than like showing you and letting you use them.
The original Mario Brothers is a really famous example of how to properly onboard players with a level 1-1, and that's another level that game design schools will study intensively, because every single aspect of it, from meeting the first Goomba to the placement of the boxes to here's where the pipe is that you can go down, is there to teach players, give players the tools that they need for the rest of the game.
Yeah, that like the first second
Mario's
on this side of the screen and he's facing, you know, the other, so you know that that's the way that Mario walks. That's the way that the scrolling is going to be the entire game. But one of the things that I have an issue with complex tutorials is I start to get anxiety.
Yeah,
that I'm gonna like forget how to do something, which has happened in games. I can't think of any specific examples off the top of my head. Although in Dragon Quest 9 on the DS, I made it significantly far in that game before I knew that you could recruit other people into your party. So I was highly, highly overleveled, and then finally found out, oh no, you do get to add other people. This isn't just a single experience. But that's like my biggest fear, is that I'm just going to forget how to do something, you know, 30 hours into the game.
You're like, where am I? Who are these people?
That's where I have to, again, like, Ubisoft's done a great job with that. When you stop playing Assassin's Creed and you go back in, it will go like, oh, do you remember that you can do this move when your meter is full? Like, they actually have systems designed to onboard you when you haven't played for a while, which I think is really clever. I do want to give a shout out, of course, to the best game of the year so far, which is Tunic, which plays around with onboarding to the point where it's obtuse on purpose. right? That entire game is designed
and it works,
around
though.
Having a manual in the game that you cannot read. It's written in a foreign language. And so it plays around with the expectations of what a manual actually does for you. And like when you start to figure it out, it makes you feel so good.
Yeah. That's cool. I need to finish that one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I also need to go back and finish it. I also, excuse me, you know, I started Persona 5, and that's another game that does a really good job.
I hate their tutorials.
Persona 5 Royal has a great opening, though.
It does. It's cool.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Has a great Royal opening as far as like setting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the original bugged me a lot. The cat telling you what to do constantly.
That's
the thing, right? You kind of want to break out of that loop. You're like, I want to explore. I don't want to go to sleep. I don't want the day to end. And it's like not clear how the systems work. And it was super frustrating.
Yeah.
And like you had to get past that where the game opens up. But
I'm not that far into Royal, but I hear they fixed a lot of that stuff. So I'm super excited to replay.
What are you playing it on? Switch?
Xbox, actually, because it's on Game Pass, so I don't have to rebuy it. Yeah,
I know. I'm an idiot. I bought it. I spent the $60 to buy it just so I could have it on Switch. But it looks really good on OLED. Doesn't perform probably as well.
I mean, it's fine. It's 30 FPS. It's basically a visual novel. Yeah. I got it on PC so I could play on Steam Deck, and it's
smart.
Looks really good on that too. Nice. If you tweak it a little bit, so
nice. Good game.
Royal is so good.
Play that.
It is.
I need to get back into it.
Finally, play it.
An incredible RPG. It is.
Yes. That's what everyone has told me for years and years, and I'm putting it off.
When you see the footage, you'll probably go like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, it's seriously. Very silly.
That's what I love games that just revel in, like, you know, if you're going to make a game that's based on an anime aesthetic, just go full anime.
Yes.
Like, it's just gorgeous. It is a beautiful game.
Yeah. It's like in House of the Dragon, the middle prince with the eye patch is an anime character.
Full anime.
But TV show. So... All right, another question. This one's from Edward Fearon from Melbourne, Australia. He asks, the Switch just recently... we already know this. When considering its success, shouldn't we be comparing the combined sales figures for other systems within a generation, meaning 3DS and Wii and DS, rather, given the quote-unquote loss of a second hardware revenue stream? If the DS and Wii were a combined system, that Fantasy Machines sales would be 250 million units. Edward wonders if the decision to combine systems at this point was a financially fruitful decision. Pear, you had something to say on this subject using facts, because I just had some cockamamie.
You were going
to
make something up. I was like, no, let's pull the numbers. So I pulled the financial numbers. So we got to make the distinction between unit sales, right, which is publishers, console manufacturers like to brag about install bases, except for Xbox. They never actually announce the numbers.
I wonder why.
Wonderful machine and it's selling well, but not as well as the PlayStation and the Switch. And so they're a little quieter about it. And traditionally they haven't been very forthcoming with numbers, but there's unit sales, which are great for bragging rights. And then there's the financial information, right? How much money are you actually making? Right. And there are multiple things you can be looking at. And so your question is, wasn't it better for Nintendo when they had two horses in the race? They had multiple machines, a home console and a handheld device. So if we go back to the heyday of kind of the, you know, Nintendo's earnings, and Nintendo had some lows, obviously, GameCube era, they lost a lot of market share. And then they came back with a vengeance with DS and the Wii. So if you go to 2009, Nintendo made $18.3 billion, right?
Is that revenue?
That is revenue. So that's all the money that comes in for buying their games and their hardware. And now remember, hardware has a slimmer margin of profit, right?
Yes.
Because there's revenue, not just R&Ds, manufacturing, marketing. When you have two horses in the race, you have to market two horses, right? You have to distribute two things. You have to manufacture two different things in two different places. You have to make different games for the two machines and so forth, right? And so your install base isn't the combination. It's unique for each one of them. And so... the money they kept, and we're not going to look at EBITDA, which most companies measure their success on, and obviously shareholders do. We're just going to look at the actual profit. Of the $18.3 billion, Nintendo made $7.9 billion profit back in 2009. So now we go to today, and, Nintendo made, hold on, where's my thing here? Nintendo made 2022 through end of March made $15 billion. So less than they made during the Wii and DS era, but they kept $8.4 billion. So they made more money by making less money, right? And that's the, it's called COGS, cost of goods and services, right? Like the cost of producing things, marketing things, selling things is now lower because they can focus on the Switch. Maybe they're more efficient. Maybe they don't have as many expenses. They don't own as many development studios that might have cost a lot of money. All of that nuance aside, they're making more money right now. But you know, like the world has also changed, right? And so if you're saying, could we go back? Could it be even better if Nintendo had a handheld and a console? I'll again go back to the fact that the world has changed. And everybody has a phone in their pocket. And so maybe having a standalone handheld line might not be the ticket nowadays.
That goes back to the second pillar thing that we were talking about last week with, should Nintendo release a VR headset?
Yeah.
I mean, that might be your answer
That's different. It's not
too niche, though, for Nintendo.
It's not a blue ocean. There are some big leaders there, like Meta, for example. And they have some challenges in that market as well, as we've seen. They just laid off a lot of people. No, but it's like there sometimes is this other pillar, and sometimes for Nintendo that's toys, right? Like Amiibo was a thing and made a lot of money, and obviously millions of those have sold, but also the micro consoles became a second pillar. And I could imagine that there is another thing like that, whether it's fitness devices, which they've dabbled in, or something that we haven't even thought of.
Or their subscription. Sensor. That's new to them. Their subscription service.
Subscription is definitely another thing. And like you could, maybe there's a future where Nintendo games aren't just on Nintendo consoles. They probably scoff at that right now because they know that you bought a Switch because you want Zelda and Mario and Pokemon and all of that. But you know, who's to say? New pillar is amusement parks and movies.
Right. That's what I think it is. Mm-hmm. I do. Yeah.
I think the Mario movie is going to make them a lot.
It's going to make bank.
I think it's
Chris Pratt is their new pillar.
Chris.
Yeah, we
just
go.
His own column on the financial report.
Yeah.
Per, this might surprise you, but I was basically going to say everything that you said.
Perfect.
Just without the facts to back it up. I wanted to quickly point out to everyone that revenue is the money that you just get, and profit is revenue minus the costs of doing business.
Minus the dollars you have to pay your little brother.
Exactly. So a lot of times I'll see people like, I'm blown away by some company's revenue, but that's not a real fair measure of their success. Because you could make $100 billion, but if you spent $999 million of that to get that, you're not doing
something. Yeah, and I don't want to make this more boring than it has to be, but it's obviously...
Oh, this is not boring to me. Like, accounting was my favorite subject.
When companies when a company is public and they're trading shares in the open market, right, they're beholden to shareholders, and a lot of their performance is directed by that as well. And by the way, Nintendo, at its scale, I've said this before, Nintendo is almost like a bank. It is actually influenced greatly by the ups and downs of the yen, and they have a lot of capital. They have a lot of money in the bank. And so their books are influenced by the ups and downs on the yen much more than you'd have with other companies. But yeah, the shareholders are very important, and some companies can be very, very successful and have high shares despite having crappy margins or not making a lot of money, right? Like you'll see companies trade very highly who haven't made a dime in 10 years. And so it's a complicated world out there. Nintendo always is seen as a very mature, very well-run business, and so it's a rock. I mean, they've had their ups and downs, but they're very revenue focused, and famously they didn't want to sell hardware at a loss, right? Whereas everybody else was selling the console and saying, we're going to lose money on the console, we're going to make all the money on software. And Nintendo said there's another way you can make money.
Why not both?
And they just sold me another Switch for $350, so clearly it works.
Well, that was the Nintendo Financial Minute. So
I learned a lot.
Final question from Ryan Gross. Ryan wants to know, with Thanksgiving around the corner, and this is obviously for U.S. people, do you have any video games you like to play with family or friends around this time, or any gaming traditions?
Yeah,
and I'm wondering, do you have any, Travis? What's your gaming tradition?
My go-to, Jackbox is obviously a staple. Everybody's got to play that.
That's a good one.
But my go-to is actually those horror games where everybody plays a different character. You know, they've been doing Until Dawn was one of them, and now they do like one every year, basically. And the one this year is. last year it was House of Ashes. You guys know what games I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yes. I can't remember the name of the company. I'm blanking. But those ones are great. You can just get it because they don't need to be gamers, right? If you're around people who just sort of like movies or whatever, and then you just go, hey, well, here's a movie where you can make decisions and we can kind of see who dies and see who lives and that sort of thing. Those things are a blast to play with a group of people and just kind of passing around the controller.
I haven't tried that. That's a great idea.
Yeah, they actually have a mode called Movie Night mode. And it's like you get one controller and you assign one character to every player, and then it will stop the movie at certain points and say, hand the controller to this person, it's their turn, right? And then you can kind of see who survives the night and who doesn't. So if you haven't experienced that, like, that's like a peak gaming experience for sure.
And that's awesome.
And you can play it with people who aren't gamers. So I make like my fiance's mom play with us and stuff, you know.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
What about you, Kat?
Excellent.
Well, I'm doing Friendsgiving this year, so we're going to be playing Smash Brothers. That's a staple of the household, and we still play a lot of Smash Ultimate, and it's a lot of fun. It's my favorite Switch game, I think. It's one of my favorites of all time. Yeah, no, I love Smash Brothers Ultimate so much. It's incredible. Who's your main? Oh, I have a lot of mains, actually. But if you put a gun to my head and said you have to pick one, probably Toon Link.
Ooh, nice.
That's the one that I'm like probably the most comfortable with. But I also just really enjoy winning with like Hero, Byleth, Pokemon Trainer.
Yeah.
I'll just go each row and pick a different character and be like, oh, today I think Terry today, you know. But when I'm with my parents are not big gamers anymore. They were a long time ago, but there was a time when they had a Wii and we would play a lot of Wii Sports. So that was
so wholesome.
A lot of golf, a lot of bowling. So
for my family, when my daughter comes to visit, we usually jump into a co-op game like Sea of Thieves or Halo with the boys. Go, we're a four player team. My wife doesn't really play games except when the extended family is here. Her mom, her sister, her brother. We usually break out Dr. Mario. Like, any classic four-player version like Dr. Mario 64 or Mario Party, whatever the latest version is that everybody can play. It's like the casual kind of Nintendo games that are either puzzles or party games always work. So we bring those out.
And Save then Thieves.
And then when everybody falls asleep, it's just my brother-in-law and I are just trading, like playing Gran Turismo and just trading off the controller whenever we switch a race.
Nice.
That's how the night ends usually.
How do you play Sea of Thieves with your family? Because that's not split screen, right? You need four devices.
Four Xboxes.
Really? Wow. That's
luck. We do. And four subscriptions.
The LAN party action.
Rolling deep.
Unfortunately. Wow. Look, I can always say it's my job too, right? So
it's a great game.
Exactly.
My wife can't get mad. Yeah, no, the kids really love playing together Sea of Thieves. And it always starts, and this is classic rare really, this is a fantastic game, really rare coming back as being a major force in development. It's just so clever and so fun, and it's about the misadventures more than the adventures. Like,
yes,
somebody accidentally shoots themselves out of a cannon and then they strand and you have to get them back. My sons were playing the other night and I heard them yelling at like 2 a.m. I'm like, what the hell is going on? And they're like, there's a guy named Kevin on that ship and he doesn't know we're here. And it's like, it's these kind of fun open world experiences that are only possible with online gaming.
Yeah.
And,
such a good game.
Would be nice to get something like this on the Switch someday.
Oh, Kevin, what a card. Yeah.
They kept on yelling Kevin at the poor guy.
Kevin, if you're out there, we're sorry.
Yeah, sorry, Kevin.
Captain Kevin, he's just trying to make his fortune on the high seas.
It's like a guy in a dinghy.
I'd say that we haven't wanted to just set out there and sail and get pirated. It's terrible. My Thanksgiving traditions, I tried to like make a point to play through the original Legend of Zelda every Thanksgiving, but I can't do that anymore because I have to work. So I don't have a Thanksgiving video gaming tradition anymore, unless you count like bringing you the best in Black Friday deals from the world of Nintendo, Xbox, Sony, PlayStation, and PC on IGN Deals. Follow us at IGN Deals on Twitter. However, over the holiday break, meaning like the Christmas break, New Year's, when we actually do have downtime and I'm not working, every year since I was, I don't know, like 10, that something awakens within me where I just want to play a turn-based RPG that's just as about, you know, like Final Fantasy VI or Final Fantasy
IV.
Sorry, I had to remember because I remember when it was Final Fantasy II and Final Fantasy III.
Yep.
But yeah, like when the days are short, I don't feel bad about playing a role-playing game for 10 hours in a stretch, because who wants to go outside anyway? So I guess the closest thing I have to a Thanksgiving tradition is a Christmas tradition of playing old school RPGs.
Just nice.
We should do another Switch co-op, best Switch co-op games for the holidays list.
That'd be good.
There are a lot of really good co-op games on this machine.
Minecraft.
Yeah.
Evergreen.
Yeah.
So Minecraft secret best co-op game. The game where you're trying to solve the pirate, the mystery.
Yes!
Obra Dinn.
Yeah, you get that game going on a Switch while everybody's sitting around the room. And they'll be pointing out and solving the mystery. It's a great conversation game.
Obra Dinn, and it's with a warm fire on in the fireplace.
Mm-hmm.
It's got
so good.
Dithering style Macintosh graphics, which I'm a big fan of. Oh, look at the dithering. Look at the dithering. That looks like a HyperCard stack on my Macintosh Classic.
God, this game was so good.
Beautiful game. One of the best games the past 5 years, for sure.
Amazing. Just so clever where it goes.
Well, yeah. I know where we're going, and that's home, because I'm afraid we're out of time. So I wanted to thank everyone who... Oh, wait. Let me try that again. Dear Lord. I redid the outro. Before we go, I have a few favors to ask. If you're watching us on YouTube, please leave us a like and a nice comment. If you're listening to us on a podcast app, please leave us a review. It helps us spread the good NVC word, and we will be forever in your debt. I want to thank our special guest, Travis. Travis, where can people find you online?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter, @TyGuyTravis, and you can read all of my stuff on IGN.com.
Heck yeah. Also, I want to thank Red for flipping switches there on the ones and twos. Most of all, thanks to you for hanging out with us. Remember, NBC is the only podcast where you can
get the thing.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.